Hello and welcome to edition 367 of the Monocle Weekly. I'm Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be getting a masterclass in how to write a novel from Man Booker Prize winner DBC Pierre. His new effort, Release the Bats, tells new writers how to throw the rule book out of the window.
I will also be talking to the actor Ethan Hawke. Oh yes, he's starring in the new film about the gifted yet troubled jazz trumpeter Chet Baker, Born to be Blue.
And later in the show, we'll be hearing the story of Emil Berliner, the inventor of the gramophone, whose influences allowed musicians from the Ramones to Amy Winehouse to have careers. Curator Joanne Rosenthal from London's Jewish Museum will be explaining a new exhibition, Jukebox, A Century on Shellac and Vinyl.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan will be inventing a few half-truths in the news look ahead, and we'll spin a tune too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So that was the week that was, Andrew. Here we are. It's Sunday, and it's been busy times in and out of the office, doing various different things. But it's been a very busy week for Monocle 24 Radio. Before we jump into the news look ahead, which tends to be a sort of humorous look at the news, it's been very difficult to keep up with things, both kind of taking an ironic distance, perhaps, from things like the cabinet reshuffle here in the United Kingdom, and then awful things like what happened in Nice. It's been busy.
It's interesting, the running of a radio station. We've been going 5 years, almost 5 years now. And it's added that kind of beat of having, you know, a newsroom at the heart of a magazine. So the strange thing was, you know, when Nice happened, you don't have to even kind of look around now. People are mobilised. Danny Giacopelli was on a plane a few hours later heading towards the story. And I think that's the most important thing is, you know, when things happen now, we're rushing there. We're not kind of pulling people out. That's what many magazines would be doing. They, get our people out. We're the opposite. We're a news brand. We're going to the story. So I'm very proud of the reporting that's been done on Monocle 24. And yeah, and meanwhile, back in the UK, you know, a sense of, you know, just I think everyone's a bit worn out by the quantity of politics that has kind of washed over us over the last few weeks. And, you know, Brits and Europeans are kind of getting on with their summers a little bit now, I think, and thinking, to hell with this, you know, we need to survive this and we need to move on. And while Monocle as a brand is, you know, very opposed to what's happening around Brexit, in the end, you know, we also have to move on, whatever that means, and to, you know, not be dependent on this one place and this one story.
Never have I felt more European when August rolls around and I want to have all of it off.
All of it off.
Not have it off with all of them. I mean, have that entire month off. Does that make you feel more European? Does it make you feel more British when you're jumping on your bike and coming into work on the 1st of August? It's pretty depressing, isn't it?
No, and you know, without being serious, yeah, the whole thing about, you know, the Brexit vote, I think it's made people feel what's important to them. And I think we all do feel quite European. You know, we sit in a team of people who are from all around the world, and that's what makes it special. And yeah, I think a few of them have it off as well in August. I mean, have August off.
Thought we'd stop all that. okay, well, it seems like exactly the right point in the programme to wheel out on his news trolley, Henry Reece Sheridan.
Henry!
Welcome, Henry.
Thanks very much, Rob. How are you?
We're very well. I think Andrew and I, here at the coal face.
Do you have it off in August? I may have August off.
I would neither, frankly. I've got to be honest with you.
Really?
It's quiet times. Maybe head down. It is, really is, yeah, in the hovel.
Chaste times.
Back in Greenland.
At Reece Sheridan Towers.
Frugal times.
But please don't talk about having your head down.
Dearie me.
Do it yourself.
But early for that on the Sunday.
Okay, off we go, Henry. Tell us what's happening in the world of news.
On Wednesday, the 20th of July, our new Prime Minister, Theresa May, is going to hold her first PMQs, Prime Minister's Questions, for those who aren't familiar with the British parliamentary system of governance. Now, as you mentioned at the top of the show, she has recently appointed her new cabinet. And I think it's a remarkable cabinet for several reasons.
It's a cabinet of curiosities,
I think. It's a cabinet of curiosities.
It's a Wunderkammer.
70% of the cabinet are state educated. Educated in what people around the world might call public schools, which might not sound remarkable, but in a British context, that's the highest proportion of state-educated ministers since Clement Attlee's Labour post-war government of 1945, which, given how sometimes rigid the British class system can seem as it maps on to people from privately educated backgrounds getting into positions of influence, I think is a real sign of progress and genuine progressive mindedness on the part of May.
Yeah, I think because she's kind of wrong-footed people in some ways, because she is very progressive on some things. Even when she she realised she was about to become PM, her first speech talked about stop and search and how it was used against young black men, about the failure to provide opportunities for young working class men who were white. So she delved into some big issues which you'd normally think of sitting with parties on the left, but then she went and appointed Boris Johnson as foreign secretary, which we'll see how that pans out. So yes, she's kept us intrigued. Yeah. Do you think she's going to get a nickname? Because I wonder if she's going to be called Tezza or something.
Tezza?
Well, because Theresa May, it sounds very formal. I think she needs a nickname.
Theresa's a difficult one to find a shortened form of, isn't it?
Tess May.
Tess May. I don't think it doesn't work for some reason. Tess is a little bit. I quite like Tezza.
Tezza.
It's like Gaza, isn't it?
I like Tezza.
Probably the only parallel between the two. I just want to say two more things, I think. I think first of all, to emphasise the extent to which Theresa May was a bogeyman among people on the left before she was Prime Minister, needs to be emphasised. I mean, she was chastised for being perceived to have an extremely hard line on immigration, a relatively hard line on crime and punishment.
But she was a Home Secretary, and if you're the Home Secretary, you have to have a line on these things. It's very easy to not have a line and never be reported as having had a line on it because it doesn't fall in your jurisdiction.
So that's true.
There's
a second person I want to mention, which is a remarkable Justine Greening, who has become the first openly gay female cabinet minister, which is a huge deal in itself, I think. And second of all, the first education secretary to have attended a comprehensive school, which I think is also really remarkable.
That's interesting, isn't it?
So, something to look forward to. See how she performs at the dispatch box in Marlborough on Wednesday.
See how she does in her common entrance exam.
Now, also today, in fact, on Sunday, the first round of the presidential election in no less than Sao Tome and Principe is taking place. You two will be familiar.
Yes,
this,
because
I'm Googling it now as we speak.
We had a very nice expo. We dispatched Steve Bloomfield there for a very tropical expo, a little kind of former Lusophone outpost, but it's still a Lusophone, but former Portuguese Empire outpost. Yes, and he loved it.
I think that's in the last issue of Monocle. Definitely something to check out.
I've seen
out
it. I'm familiar with it. That's where the chocolate comes from.
That's where the chocolate comes from.
Now, I think this is really extraordinary. There is 111,000 registered voters. How do you appeal? Is that just a completely different type of political operation trying to appeal to that small group of people?
Yeah, it's nice.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder. I'm just really interested in the marketing of that, like how it works. That's like a small kind of. You could almost do that on MailChimp. Couldn't you? I mean, it's a very small.
What that is, I mean, that's essentially. It's like, that's sort of when you can. It's a bit like sort of fixing the church roof, isn't it?
Yeah.
You basically,
parish.
And if you don't like the colour of the milk cartons, I'll change them. It's those sorts of small things that can make big differences in people's lives. It must be very satisfying. Actually,
if you don't like the chocolate wrapper, I'll change it.
Exactly.
You could give everyone a bar of chocolate. You could bribe everyone.
Imagine. I know. Exactly.
That's probably going
Willy Wonka style.
Don't want to cast aspersions on the political process of Sao Tome and Principe. I wish the country a free and fair election.
Yeah.
And I hope it gets the leader it deserves. And finally, it is the final of the Jaeger LeCoultre Gold Cup British Open Polo Championship.
Oh, nice.
Taking place... Where's it taking place? At the Cowdray Park Polo Club. We're all familiar.
In God's own county of West Sussex. This is literally 5 miles from Bound Terra.
You are familiar?
Terra Bounder.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. I've been to this. It's very good.
Go on. I was hoping you'd be able to. It's part of what is a...
The best thing about the polo is it's quite fun and there's lots of champagne knocking about and all the rest of it. But the commentator at Cowdray Park Polo is exceptionally good.
Go on.
Because he's completely bananas. I don't know, people around the world might be familiar with an old commentator called Murray Walker, who's used to commentate on the Formula One motor racing on the BBC. He was very famous and pretty famous all around the world. He's in that vein of the enthusiastic amateur and the man who is... He's like the Icelandic football commentator that we loved so much in the European Football Championships recently. So he's nuts. He can't really keep his... He can't keep his powder dry for there's, excitement.
There's no pretense of objectivity whatsoever.
There it goes! It's in! It's
like, he's like that. That style. Yeah, so he's good. If it's still the same commentator, that's very good.
My facts tell me that this is considered part of the next phrase in quotation mark, the season of social events. Anyone know anything about that? Don't move in those circles. I'm not going to pretend otherwise.
That's the Lord's Test. It's the Henley Regatta. It's the Wimbledon. It's Ascot. It's those things, yeah.
Okay.
Tiddlywinks Championships.
Sure.
All-night party at 9 Canterbury Square.
All important fixtures.
Those things, yeah.
Okay. Summer balls. Yeah.
Yeah.
Put those in your hat.
Bow ties and tails all around.
Andrew, take them out of your hat.
Why are we talking about... No one's wearing a hat.
I don't know. He's dragged the name of the news looker through the mud.
Should we move on before this turns into kind
That's
of
it.
Like...
That's it. That's my lot.
We reveal to everybody Henry's lack of knowledge about most things. Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
As proof of Writerly credentials, winning the Man Booker Prize does the job very nicely. And our first guest today on the Monocle Weekly, DBC Pierre, did just that in 2003 with his debut novel, Vernon Godlittle.
But he wants to show other writers that a good book is in everyone's grasp. So his latest title is something of a how-to in writing. Release the Bats is a writer's guide that's part memoir, part reflection and part practical manual. But it eschews many traditions of the trade. Structure, for example, gets short shrift. According to Pierre, or Peter as he's also known, the job is better split and performed backwards. Don't build a house and furnish it, but knock up some furniture on a binge and see what architecture it wants. And he joins us now. Pierre, thank you very much for coming in to visit us with Release the Bats under your arm. Fantastic name for anything, including a book. So we should start at the beginning, which, and you can tell us whether that's the right way to conduct this actually as well. What on earth is it like to see that blank flickering laptop page in front of you, or indeed the white page in front of you?
Oh, it's terrifying. That's the only key to beginning to write is to get something down.
Yeah.
And half of the lessons in here are about how to tolerate crap, because the first things that go down are usually obviously not finished writing, but just having something on there. Based on the simple science that it's much easier to improve something than to originate something. So whatever you put down will not only have the seeds of what you need to write, but is infinitely easier to improve than it is to put down from scratch perfectly.
So it's about what making that famously making that white page black.
Yeah, and just close your eyes and do it even.
And the push for this, you know, the idea of doing this book, because when you read it, the amazing thing is you do feel very kind of nicely encouraged. Is that because you faced periods when you couldn't get anything down, or you faced periods of writer's block, or you just know that you need a helping hand every now and then?
Yeah, I haven't as yet, touch wood, faced absolute block, but obviously it is like it's an unpredictable tap. You don't know when you're going to be writing well or not, and you have to push through it. But I just thought, I was actually reading a book by a surgeon who said it's the common practice in surgery school to watch one, do one, and then teach one. And I thought that's a lovely idea.
Yeah, right.
And that's how they pass on the craft. And so in the interim of writing a novel, there's a big novel being written in the background of this. But it was also useful for me to remember what it was like coming to it from scratch. And putting a book together just from a feeling and figuring it all out. And it was particularly interesting because I had no education in it and I hadn't sat around thinking about it and hadn't been to any courses or groups and stuff. So,
and you said you weren't even particularly a bookish person as a young guy.
No, I'm a very slow reader. I love books and I love language and everything. So I wasn't quite raised by apes, but...
wolves, I heard.
Wolves. There's actually an Italian article written by a muse of Ernest Hemingway, who's no longer with us, who I met in Italy, and she wrote a beautiful article. After exhorting me that I couldn't go into this naked as myself, she said, you need a figura. Yeah. Said, these were all the great writers were strange people. Don't do it as yourself. They will destroy you. And she actually wrote an article in the Corriere della Sera in Rome, suggesting that I was raised by foxes on a mountainside.
It's a bit like Rome's founding story. I like it. And exactly. You crawled naked across broken glass, killed your brother, and finally here we are in the Monocle studio.
Exactly, yeah.
What I wanted to know at the end of reading this book was whether you felt like you'd let a little bit too much daylight in upon magic, whether it helps to do that, whether it helps to kind of give some of the tricks of the trade away. Because presumably every writer, every creator kind of jealously guards the secret elixir, doesn't he?
Well, I wonder if they do. I have to say, when I was starting to write, I couldn't find, Ernest Hemingway didn't write a book about how this is done and did keep stuff close to his chest. And maybe there is a habit of hiding the ladder, because when you look at it and when you butt heads with it directly in your own work, there are some very simple shortcuts. The formulas, the secrets are easier than you think. And I just thought, really, people are struggling with the wrong part of the job. Yeah. We struggle with, you could do a PhD course in how you structure a novel. In fact, that's not what people read them for. And we can't compete with great structures anyway. All we're looking for is a vehicle for what we uniquely have to say. And everyone has got their particular individual voice. It's just a question of finding the framework for that to come out best, and that's quite easy. So I thought it was, apart from reminding myself how it worked as I wrote this novel, I thought it was an easy thing to pass that on.
And being a writer is also something you touch on. You say, all sorts of people can be a writer. But for you, because this is part memoir as well, when did you realise that you felt you were a writer, though? I guess that's for many people when they're sitting at home, as you described, sitting in your underpants, writing. You're thinking, am I a writer? Is it the point that you get published or that, your agent signed you up? When did you feel that sense that you had made that journey?
I was first a writer when I first wept with frustration, and I knew it then. Like, there's no sensible reason to put yourself through anything as confusing and confounding as it can be, because that was by choice. And you have this, there's a phenomenon, especially if you're writing a novel, you jump into the shore of it and start swimming, and you get to 50 or 100 pages and it's too late then to turn back.
Yeah.
But it can get incredibly difficult, and you have to press on, and, it's a really blind, naked swim across the sea. So that's when I decided I was a writer. I think actually as soon as you sit down to write and make the decision, you're a writer.
I wondered where you stood on the idea of what books are kind of about, or what they seem about on the surface. The character might be a surgeon. I liked your allusion to a surgeon. Let's stretch to that analogy.
Yeah,
just like writing, just close your eyes and do it. And I was speaking to someone about television earlier this week, and they come up with TV shows, and they were saying, shows about stuff are being pushed to the margins. Everything has to be relatable. If a show is about cars, or is about cooking, it's actually about the people that do the cooking. It's about the mistakes they might make and all the rest of it. And I wonder where you stood on that. Could a novel be set in space or set in medieval France? But if it is presumably about the characters, is where do you stand on that? Because novels have to be about stuff as well as what people do in that framework.
Well, my position is that they can be about anything, and they should be. We should always be trying to break the notion of any formats at all. But we have to remember as well, it's not the writers and are not the program makers or the artists that do any of that formatting. That is the middle class who produces the content. So, if it's a television program, the producers will be forcing it into that box based on their judgment and based on the you know, the broader research that they might have. The beautiful thing about literature and about book is that you can explode into it in any way you want and make it whatever you want. And only a publisher will decide if you know, if it works well enough to get through the net, but it doesn't stop you doing it.
You do a rather nice thing at the end of the book, which is you kind of you reduce all your amazing writing to like several snaps,
tweets.
Each chapter is reduced to just like chapter five. The boy stood on the burning deck, and then
yeah.
Why did you think that it was this? Is this because you do want the book to be practical in a way that it's go back? You know, it's reducing it to its essence. You felt you would go back that people could remind themselves. Okay, before I start today, this is the kick I need.
Do you know the actual spur for writing this, or the final spur for writing this, was going into a high security prison and speaking with some prisoners there who had a writing group, and one of them came up to me after the show and said that he was having real trouble because he'd been in so long that he'd forgotten what the streets were like outside and he didn't have access to internet. And I started to answer his question, and we were separated by guards and he was taken away and I never saw him again. And it was, it touched me a lot actually to have to leave them in the prison. And, so I started the book writing to him specifically, and it was in my mind that because every chapter ends with a key that's helpful to writing, I thought he could rip those pages out and stick them on the wall of his cell.
And that leads to just endless imagination. You can fill in any blank you want after that, right?
Exactly.
And they're
yeah.
all a kickoff. Yeah. They're all a. Yeah.
I also like the very, very final page where you which hints at a kind of a relationship, I wonder, that you have with your publisher, because that you just list terms used in publishing letters and what they mean, one of which is can't wait to catch up, which actually means when can I see some pages, and a drink Tuesday, show me some pages. Are you someone that the publisher does chase a little bit too?
Well, I've been through a period of chasing, and that's simply... that's the downside of having a successful book. If your books just tick along, if they're, you know, if they don't win a big prize and don't make a lot of money for the publisher, you won't hear from them. But
so it's nice to be in a state of enchasement.
If it's successful, then they're looking for the next one. And if they've paid you in advance, they want that money back as well. And so that's just natural business. And
That strange added pressure of success then for a writer, did that kind of change the way that you could do your job in some sense? Did you feel when you woke up, oh my God, this is tough now?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's taken a decade to come back to the beginning because you have to learn a whole new set of ropes, and now it's, you know, and I have the same you know, great relationships, and we've all been through a cycle. It was kind of a first for them as well. But to have a prize thrown at the first book before you even really knew what you'd done, and I guess that could be one of the reasons behind writing this as well, was, you know, just to remember actually how that came into being, that book. But it's certainly a learning curve once you're published, and finally, you know, we learn how to tolerate and ignore and deal with each other.
And just finally, the people are I've got a very good book upstairs, which is about daily routines of everyone from Gauguin to Martin Amis.
I've got that.
It's good, isn't it?
That is a fantastic book.
So people are. So you know what I'm going to ask you, because people are interested in the rhythm and habit of creativity, aren't they? They feel like if you get up in the morning and you smoke a Camel and have an espresso, you'll write a novel like your favourite novelist or painter or, you know, Keith Richards, whoever it is. So what about you?
We should mention that book. It's by Mason Curry.
That's right.
It's called Daily Ritual.
Yeah. Does it help to be in a routine, or do you not have one?
I believe it does, but I don't have one.
do you need to work on the habits?
I'm working on it. I work by night because I'm really sensitive to anyone looking over my shoulder.
Right.
And the nth degree of that complex is that by night, people aren't even thinking about you because they're all in bed. So I like night because it's empty and the hours are free. And also you're not eating. Your body has stopped tracking the sun's passage across the sky and the phone's not going to ring and etc. But I would like to develop a routine. And from reading books like Daily Rituals, I've seen that a lot of your really productive writers ended up with a very firm routine. They trained their muse to visit at a certain time every day. Most of them seem to have worked for no more than 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
A lot of them seem to get it out of the way early, do it before anything else, and then take the rest of the day off. And of course, the work is still gestating. Mm. But the key is once you've begun a book, once the door is open, it keeps writing itself in your mind, even whether you're there or not. So, you know, I think in future I will get a routine of probably 5 to 6 hours. But in the meantime, what I do is sit pointlessly in front of the screen, just do my thinking there.
That's what I keep saying to Andrew, who is also my boss.
Yeah.
I only really need 3 hours here, max a day.
I like to put my best work in.
Yeah, it's a question of the concentrated work. Yeah, yeah, what's the gold to mud ratio of what we're
exactly.
doing?
And
I would love to just have solid gold for 3 hours, yeah. but the truth is I can sit there 14 and 15 hours a day and get an hour's gold. But that's still gold, you know,
yeah.
and that's sometimes you just have to do that digging.
Well, the man that works by night segues neatly into Release the Bats, the title of a fantastic memoir, how-to guide, and a very charming and a wonderful read, of course, as well. So we should say thank you to our author, born and raised by foxes on the bank of the Tiber, BBC Pierre.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Time for some new music now. This is from sometime Hot Chip member Sarah Jones. It's a new project called Pillow Person, and this is Go Ahead.
That was some slinky electro pop from Pillow Person, and you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Are you a pillow person, Andrew?
Not sure.
Are you a duvet hogger? No, this is a very valid question, actually, off the back of that. Are you a two pillow or a one person or a no pillow person?
I'm two pillows when I get into bed.
Yeah.
And read for 10 minutes and then throw
down.
One across the room.
Yeah, me too. Always. I like a flat one. I like the cheaper pillow. I don't like the down pillows. I like a sort of nasty thin nylon pillow for some reason.
I like a thinner pillow. I don't like a big pillow. I don't like feeling kind of you're sitting up in bed.
next week we'll be talking about duvets. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Time now to welcome some Hollywood royalty to the show. Ethan Hawke, the Oscar-nominated actor known for his roles in such films as Boyhood, The Dead Poets Society and the Before Sunrise trilogy, is now starring in Born to be Blue.
It's the biopic of the jazz musician Chet Baker, the trumpeter who has star shone brightly from the 1950s onwards before succumbing to a damaging drug habit that saw him spend time in and out of jail. Rob was joined by Ethan Hawke a little bit earlier to talk all about it. But first, let's hear a clip from the film.
He's got severe trauma to the neck. He's lost all his front teeth.
28 years of practice gone. He'll never play again.
What did you do?
You're gonna kill yourself because you can't play trumpet anymore?
Yes.
Forget about Birdland. All you need now is some time.
And you. Hey, Junior. You trying to dry out again?
Stay. You come a long way, but...
What?
It's not your playing that I'm worried about.
Miles said come back once you lift a little. I lived a little.
I want to play. All I want to do is play.
I want my life back.
So, Ethan, thanks for your time today. I wondered, first of all, how you research a role like this, whether you are trying to find clips, whether you're reading books, or whether it's simply those jazz LPs themselves that inform how you play Chet Baker.
Yeah, it's a good question. This one came about in a very strange way, which is that when I was about 28, 29, Richard Linklater and I started scheming about making a movie about Chet Baker. And I got really passionate, really serious about it. We had a script and workshopped it, but we never ended up making the movie. And that was about 15 years ago, right? And so then all of a sudden this new script shows up on my, you know, mailbox of, it felt like I was being offered the sequel to a movie I didn't make 15 years ago.
Confusing position to be in.
Yeah, but I'd already done a ton of research about him. And I was already pretty deeply immersed in the music and the legend of Chet. And then, interestingly enough, in the intervening 15 years, you know, access to information is, you know, I can go online and listen to interviews of Chet on a Swedish radio in 1984. It's amazing the things you can start to find out. And when you start putting the feelers out, things start to come to you. You know, people say, oh, I didn't meet this guy. He played with Chet for 2 years. And so I talked to various different people, and mostly I just read. It was one of the most fun things about the shoot for me is every night I would just come home, and just because there's infinite material out there, I'd just keep reading more and more Chet Baker things and find a funny quote that he said here, and I'd try to get that in the movie, and a funny thing somebody else said over here, and I'd try to get that in the movie, and I just kind of pooled together this hodgepodge of knowledge. And really what I was trying to do is not do an imitation or not do anything like that, but just try to give you the spirit of the legend, kind of like what you just said about if you did just close your eyes, lay down on the floor of your apartment and listen to 2-3 Chet Baker albums in a row, what images would come? What's the story you'd want to hear? And I feel like this movie is very much the story that might just erupt from that record player.
Yeah, it seems that way. And the movie has an improvisational feel to it. It has a kind of jazz vibe to it. Was that something very definite that you and the director worked on to get that feel of it? Kind of it drifts in and out of moods very successfully. Is that something you wanted to achieve?
Very much. I mean, that was the goal, is to try to make a jazz film that we didn't want to be too self-conscious about it. It should kind of riff and find a melody for a while and then change key and into a different melody. And Robert really encouraged me to be as playful and loose on set as possible. He really enjoyed it. And I could be very flexible with the text. And, you know, as long as we stayed on point, and it created a great energy on set. And that energy is kind of what you're trying to collect into a movie. It made it hard to edit because we had a lot of material and a lot of playful material and where to find the right balance. The final film is very much kind of what we were going after.
And he's got Chet in the movie it's an interesting part of his life for you to play. I mean, he's on and off the dope. He's in and out of love, mostly in this movie. It ends, we won't spoil this for our listeners, it ends on a really nice will or won't he kind of moment. But it's an interesting kind of point to play. Was that ever up for discussion between you and Robert Boudreau, the director? I mean, where, how to end it, which bit to kind of focus on? Because it's a bit that you seem sort of primed to play at this point in your career as well, Ethan.
Well, yeah, the great thing about working with Robert was that everything was flexible and up for debate and to talk about. I mean, he was incredibly collaborative with me, and it was a great mixture of confidence. He knew exactly what he wanted, and he also was really open to finding, you know, what perhaps might be the best way to explore this moment. And in the end of the movie is, for me, very interesting. And there were two things that made me sure I wanted to do the movie. One was the opening, the idea of where I got to play Chet Baker acting as himself in a movie. That was a really, I love that opening. And I love the ending, that this idea that a person could have a huge professional triumph and a personal failure at a symbiotic moment. And the movie is very non-judgmental. It just kind of presents the situation. And I like that.
Yeah, and you don't play it with loads of you don't lay this stuff on thick, like, oh no, you know, he's made the right choice, he's made the wrong choice. You kind of let the audience make themselves up, their own minds up. And I suppose that's just, is that something that was natural to the man himself, to Chet Baker, that he kind of had an ambivalent relationship to this stuff because he felt it infected the music?
Well, he had kind of an ambivalent relationship, it seems to me, to just about everything. But one of the things that I heard in one of these funny interviews I found it was like early. I would listen to interviews and stuff as I got dressed. And one morning, through a friend of a friend, I stumbled on this really long, meandering interview that he had done, in which he got obsessed with Billie Holiday, talking about Billie Holiday. And I learned a lot from this. And we put part of it in the movie, is that it was an interesting point of view about Billie Holiday, because he kept saying, you know, that the junk didn't kill Billie Holiday, the cops did. You know, he kept saying that they took away her medicine, they take away her club cards. You know, I mean, it's just criminal what they were doing to her. And he really didn't find heroin to blame at all. He just saw that as necessary for her to do her art. And why would, if people just let her use, then she would be able to make money, and if she make money, everybody would win. It's just, why are they so judgmental? And just hearing him riff about it, I had a little insight as to his attitude about it all. And because what obviously he was talking about himself, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I put a little improv of that in there with the parole officer that Robert put in the finished film. And I think it's a little indicative of his attitude. He just kind of felt like society is full of so many lies. Society is such a joke that why does he have to play along with this phony society?
Yeah, it's a good line, isn't it? It's like, I don't have a problem with dope. I have a problem with cops or with guys like you or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you've referenced this before, actually, but those beautiful William Claxton photographs of Chet Baker. There's some good chiseled features in there. There's some good hair. And there's some very good 50s styles in there, right? There's some very, very cool kind of California cardigans in there and stuff. Was this a good thing to kind of research? I mean, this is a wardrobe that could kick off another fashion revolution when this movie comes out. Was this kind of fun? You obviously have the ups of this side of it, but then the downs of the teeth, which people are going to work out when they see the film.
I got the cool shirts. Unfortunately, I didn't get that my teeth.
What's that like? Because there's a bit of vanity, just as there is in good-looking jazz trumpeters, as there is in Hollywood stars. Is that a non-negotiable in the script? The bad teeth.
Well, it's part of the mystery of Chet Baker. This whole, you know, I mean, the movie is not factually accurate at all. I mean, it's trying to tell you a story, and it's kind of playing on the legend of Chet Baker. And one of the legends of Chet is that he lost his teeth. You know, it's like when you hear about, if you start diving into Chet, you hear these weird things like in the middle of his life, he was seen pumping gas, and he didn't have any teeth, or, you know, there's all these. You know, he played with Charlie Parker. He fights with Miles Davis. You know, there's all these things that are kind of the legend of Chet. And the losing his teeth is a really mysterious one, because, you know, he never told the same story about how it happened twice, basically. I mean, he just always was making up a different story about it. But it's a remarkable thing, because there's something beautiful or deeply human at it, because how could somebody willfully destroy themselves on drugs so much when they would work so hard to return to play music? You know, in truth, the movie shortens this period where he was learning to play again to kind of makes it seem like 2 years. It was really like 8 years that he was on methadone and taught himself to play again. This incredibly difficult thing to do. And he obviously loved doing it. Or he loved jazz, and he wanted to be a jazz musician, and that was who he was. And it was extremely painful for him to learn to play again. And, you know, this is kind of his like little Shakespearean wrinkle, his Achilles heel his whole life. You know, when he was a boy, he lost one tooth at first, and it weakened his embouchure, and that's why he started singing in the first place. He always liked to sing, not because he thought he was such a great singer. He did like singing, but it really gave his mouth a rest in a set. If he would sing one song a set, he could break up the set and his embouchure. He was very worried about his embouchure his whole life, and it's an interesting thing that this weakness he perceived, he kind of made worse.
And I just wanted to finally, on the jazz side of things, I'd love to touch on that competitive element. I mean, we start off in a jazz club with Miles Davis eyeing him across a smoky room, And that is reprised actually at the end of the movie, I guess, but in more successful circumstances. What was that like? Do you get that competitive thing amongst those guys that were too cool for school, but then would kind of make sure that nobody else could get up and play a gig that night? Do you kind of get that?
Sure. And, you know, in that particular case, it's really, because Miles is just unbelievable. I mean, you know, he was really the Mozart of that scene. He was operating at such a higher level, but was so ungracious about it. He let everybody know he was the best, you know. And I think for people like Chet, you know, who was in love with black music and in love with black culture, and it's the only world he wanted to be a part of, you know, and I think it was sincere love. I mean, playing with Charlie Parker was a high point of his artistic life. You know, I mean, just the stories are so funny. I mean, there's one story of the one time Miles and Chet were supposed to play together at the Lighthouse in L.A. And Miles would only go on when they took Chet Baker's 45s out of the jukebox and broke them. And the really mysterious part of the story is that Chet just laughed. You know, he was so happy to get to play with Miles Davis that he didn't really care if Miles mocked him. And apparently he once tried to say to Miles that Chet had won Trumpeter of the Year, and he told Miles that he wanted to apologize, to write Miles an apology letter. And Miles apparently said, "There's so many brothers you have to write that apology to before you even get to me." You know, Dizzy, Miles, Cliff Brown, Louis Armstrong. I mean, it's embarrassing you get that prize. He just mocked him for it, you know. And of course, he's right. I mean, you know, I mean, Chet was an amazing trumpeter and a great talent, but he was really imitating what others had done.
And what about learning to play yourself? I mean, this is there's the playing that you have to do enough to get away with those scenes, and they're up close and personal, aren't they? I mean, you know, there's a lot of your face in this movie playing these notes, and then there's playing because you love that music anyway. On which side of the divide are you, Ethan? Because that looks like some pretty good puffed out cheeks in this movie.
One of the great joys of my life about being an actor is to get to explore these different lives, these different worlds, you know, to take, have an, I mean, who doesn't, everybody's New Year's resolutions are like, I want to learn an instrument. I want to learn a language. I want to horseback ride or whatever it is, you know, and I get these permissions, you know, where somebody, it's part of my job to get trumpet lessons 5 times a week for a given movie. And a little bit after this, I did a remake of The Magnificent Seven, where all of a sudden it was my job to get horseback riding lessons every day. How fun is that? I'm well suited to this job because I am really curious about doing lots of different things. I really like it. I loved it. The singing was very hard and very scary to me, too. There was a lot of challenges in this movie.
Horseback riding to jazzing, that is an amazing thing. There's been some fantastic roles out there, so we should basically look for a gap in your CV that says hasn't yet played a race car driver or something and expect you to see in something like that.
And then I'll go after it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. It's better than evening classes.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm Ethan Hawke. Thank you very much indeed for your
time.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
We're going to finish today's show by taking something of a historical trip and a musical journey too. In the late 19th century, a German Jewish immigrant to the US changed the world. Emil Berliner was his name, and he came up with the idea of spinning a slab of wax in order to enjoy our favourite sounds. He invented the gramophone and the record, and it could be argued that Berliner's invention inspired a century of musical innovation that followed.
That's the centrepiece of Jukebox Jukebox, a century on shellac and vinyl, and our listeners will have no idea that there's a play on words there regarding the spelling there, which effortlessly fits J-E-W into jukebox, and it's at London's Jewish Museum. There we are, and its curator is Joanne Rosenthal, and she joins us now. Jo, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That is not a play on words that suits the radio very well. That aside, let's talk through this fine show. And actually, before we switched on the microphones, we were saying we could do this at any point. You could have done this show in the 60s, you could have done it in the 1930s, you could have done it in the 70s. I mean, it's taken till now to celebrate sort of the Jewish interest in pop music and in the manufacture of it. What line do you tread between the making of records and the making of hit records, if you know what I mean. The industry and the inspiration, I suppose.
Well, that's one of the fun things about the show, actually. There's high and low. There's kind of million-selling records that everyone's going to recognise, and then there's wonderful kitsch that has been dug out of people's record collections all around the world. Yeah. So it's a mixture of both. But I should say, actually, I think when, you know, saying the show could have been put together at any point is a really good point. But the advent of the internet and the digital world, ironically, for a show that's celebrating analog, you know, analog culture and music culture in that sense, I think it was a lot easier to put the show together because this really brought record collectors and music enthusiasts together from all around the world. And we've put together music from collections. It's a truly global international exhibition.
So before we dive into the actual records, why did you take the starting point as Emil Berliner, and how significant a character was he?
Well, Berliner is incredibly important. Like you say, what bigger revolution in the world of music is the invention of the record and the gramophone? But I should say the starting point is 10 years earlier. Thomas Edison, everyone knows Thomas Edison, the inventor. Before Berliner came up with the gramophone and the circular music playing device of the record, Thomas Edison was tinkering around trying to improve the technology of the telephone, and he accidentally invented what's known as the phonograph, which was a kind of recording device that worked with the cylinders. And he didn't, interestingly, realize the potential of what he'd invented. He thought he'd basically invented a late 19th century dictaphone, essentially. And Berliner, 10 years later, patented a much better version of a similar sort of record-playing technology, much more advanced, much more easily replicable and cheaper to produce. So he seized upon the potential that this actually could completely transform the way music is consumed. It invented the possibility of a music industry as we know it. Before then, there was no way of recording music. And, you know, and capturing sound, which is a massive revolution.
Yeah,
sound was just live until that point.
Yes,
there was
exactly.
No way of capturing any sound.
Joe, there's so many avenues in which we could talk, but I wanted to talk about the music, strangely enough. And having said, you know, we could mount this exhibition in any decade, from Dylan to Amy Winehouse, even just recently, people be interested to ascribe a kind of idea of creative Jewishness to this, actually. I mean, I interviewed once about advertising, and they said there is such a great way of doing a line. It's almost like the way Woody Allen writes a line in one of his movies, that there is an idea of Yiddish that has a rhythm to the sentence or the rest of it. Is this something that you explore in the exhibition, to find some sort of musicality in the way that people speak and operate and sing?
We do, but it's really, really global. So there's a lot of the Yiddish stuff in there. And one of my favourite sections, actually, is comedy records. Not really music at all. It's these fantastic comedy records that go back decades. And it
this
is a century
of records.
This isn't
just Weird Al Yankovic, you know.
Exactly. Or Kinky Friedman or Lenny Bruce. But yeah, going back to Mickey Katz records that have these fantastic, lurid 60s covers, these very kitsch covers. There is Woody Allen. There's this kind of Yiddish culture that runs through the show. But I think the thing we look at is the thing that links everything, because we look at all corners of the globe. There's the Middle East, there's North Africa, there's a really, really interesting strand of Arab Jewish music. The thing that links it all is immigration and movement and cross-fertilisation of cultures. So wherever Jews were, they're kind of drawing from and sharing with the cultures that they're among. So one of the central questions of the show is, what is Jewish music? Is there such a thing as Jewish music?
Yeah.
Is it music made by Jews? Is it music made for Jews? Is it music made by Jews for Jews? All these kind of reductive definitions that don't work at all. But the thing that's linking it is how Jewish culture is a global culture. And if you kind of start digging deep, you start looking, you know, to tell the story of Jewish music, you're telling the story of Egyptian music and obviously American music, Polish music, German music. There's no one simple
answer.
There's
no beginning
and there
is no end. I feel like I'm quoting a song here.
One of the great things about the show is the span of stuff that's on display. So from early wax cylinders of the 1890s with Jewish cantors, synagogue music made to be played on the Edison phonograph displayed alongside an early machine, to, like you say, Amy Winehouse or Peaches and Gonzalez, all these kind of experimental punk electronic musicians working today, who in different ways, explicitly, less explicitly, in playful ways, in kind of deliberately provocative ways, are kind of touching on some of these issues. And one of the last, second to last sections of the show talks about punk, and kind of one of the great, as the show says, one of the great last rebellions in music, and how Jewishness was playing a part, Jewish musicians like the Ramones rebelling against their upbringings. Tommy Ramone, son of Holocaust, you know, Holocaust survivors, Blitzkrieg Bop was their first, you know, their debut single, the first big hit and stuff.
And the Beastie Boys doing the Beastie Boys doing the same thing with hip hop and stuff.
Exactly, yeah. The Beastie Boys feature, yeah. There's a really nice story about the Beastie Boys actually in the show.
I'm just teeing them up here for you, not them straight down the middle.
And tell me, the people who come to the show, I presume that, you know, you have the Jewish community in London coming, you have many other people come through your front door. Does the show work in another way as well, which is, you know, and we see this with, you know, gay culture, black culture, all sorts of cultures which feel that sometimes it's not noticed what their contribution is. Is part of your job here with this show to say to people who are non-Jewish, do you realise how much you get from the Jewish community in a way?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a celebration of Jewish culture and what Jews have contributed to the music industry. Some of the really interesting things that I was really surprised by, we talked about the invention of the gramophone and the record, but the invention of the record sleeve. Alex Steinwise, a graphic designer in Columbia in the 40s, came up with this, you know, suggestion, why don't we market records in individual sleeves? Before that, they were just in kind of neutral sleeves or record label sleeves. And, you know, that completely changed the way that music is consumed and sold. And talking about audiences, one way of appreciating the exhibition as well as the Jewish contribution in this Jewish story is purely a kind of joyous celebration of the wonderful world of record sleeve art, you know.
Yeah.
One aspect of the exhibition is this, you know, overwhelmingly kind of visual display of hundreds, over nearly 500 records just laid out in front of you. And you get this, a century of record sleeve art as well, which is a really interesting thing to see from, like I say, the late 1900s to present
day. And we should explain that people can listen to a lot of this music as well.
Yeah. There's a central feature in the exhibition, which is a giant listening booth. The idea of the exhibition is to kind of give people the sense that they are in a record shop and they can look at music, rifle through music, and listen to music. And it's a very, very interactive exhibition. So there are lots and lots of interactive stations where you can listen to records, but also listen to cultural historians, musicians, collectors, curators talking about records and talking about music and records that have meant something to them personally. So there's lots of lovely anecdotes and curiosities and interesting kind of bits of music trivia that I think for, you know, serious musos and people with a passing interest in. I think there's something for everyone there, definitely.
So you basically need to put a time limit on your exhibition. Because you said, yeah, we had the press for you recently.
We
and
couldn't get
people,
rid of the
people
journalists.
People were there for 6 hours. People were bringing sandwiches and
people
thermos flasks.
And the nice thing is,
it's not to be done.
You know what it's like with music fans. I'm a music fan. Everyone's the same. Everyone's trying to show how much they know. Oh, I've got that. And you just see people kind of chatting and trying to impress each other with their own record collections or their own stories. It's really sociable. It's quite nice. It's unconventional in that way for a museum exhibition. It's experiential and it's participatory and it's a lot of fun.
Well, that's what people, the holy grail of museum shows is to be interactive, but you've done it in a whole different way, I guess.
Yeah.
People are just bragging rights. Oh, I've got that. I've got the original pressing of that from 1938.
Exactly.
Joe Rosenthal, curator of From Jukebox to Jukebox. Thank you very much indeed. We should also point out, you created this show in London. It's going to Warsaw next.
Yeah.
And you picked it up, actually. The show is a travelling circus, isn't it?
It's growing as it travels through Europe. It started in Austria in a fantastic museum called the Jewish Museum in Hohenems. And they curated the original exhibition, and it's been through various other European cities. We're one stop on a long tour. And we've added a lot of UK context and content to the show. But it originated in Austria.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for talking us through it. And thanks for your time, Joe Rosenthal.
Thank you.
And that is it, Andrew, for edition 367 of the Monocle Weekly. I enjoyed today's show a lot, actually.
I did too, and the only point...
Why no, are you... No, you're not reading... It sounds like you're reading that off
no,
a piece of paper.
No, I didn't.
I did too. It was really good.
It was a very nice show. The only problem is you did point out that puns sometimes don't work well on radio.
Puns?
Jukebox.
Oh, Duke and Jukebox. Yeah, that was quite a difficult introduction to make, wasn't it?
Yes, but you did very well.
I sort of had to literally spell it out. That's an interesting show, and that's I think it's been a travelling show, but it's a good one. It's one of those things we didn't manage to touch on in the interview, is all the managers and the kind of, you know, the money men and the kind of big management people behind all the bands as well.
Yeah, no, it's
a big part of Jewish music history is the structure of the whole thing, and you know how it all works. It's kind of an interesting thing.
And also, I think that journey through pop music, you know, reminding people, you know, that Bob Dylan has Jewish roots, you know, that all these amazing kind of people that, in a way, for
Robert Zimmerman,
of people kind of forget, you know, their kind of heritage, and it's an amazing thing. And nice to talk to Ethan Hawke.
Yes, yeah, so he was very cool. That's a good movie. It's kind of, they've done it as like a jazz album, so it's kind of quite it's quite moody, and it's a little bit sort of experimental. But stick with it; it's very beautiful. He's a very good looking man. He's kind of kept his vibe, hasn't he?
Yes, he has.
He's a man who was very good looking to begin with, and he seems to have got better. He seems to have aged incredibly well. Although in this film, he's had to take one for the team and knock out his front teeth for half of the film because Chet Baker got in lots of fights. Lots of jealous lovers seem to follow him around the world and knock his front teeth out. So that aside, Ethan Hawke on fine form. Ethan Hawke wasted on the radio. Who knows? People, answers on a postcard to at monocle.com. Should we say thanks to our friends?
Yes, I'm going to thank the show's producer, Tom Hall.
I'm going to thank the researcher, Barclay Bran. Do you want to thank our studio manager? That was Toby Hammond.
And do you know what? We're going to be back the same time next week.
Same place?
Why not? But from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Robert Bounds. Thanks for tuning in.